we've got Diane Dolan here to speak to us about inequality in the UK. So Danny is a professor of geography at Oxford, and he's famous for talking a lot in recent years about growing income inequality and why it matters. And his latest book is about to come out. There are details on the flyers, but essentially it's about what governments can do to minimise inequality and the effects of inequality. And Stefan is an FT journalist and the director of the High Pay Centre, and also a Labour activist. He's had some part
very lazy activist.
You've had some part in advising Ed Miliband, so you know, maybe do
that worked really well.
Well, yeah, I mean, not necessarily the same kind of activism.
I deliver leaflets.
That's all good. Okay.
I leave the house and deliver
leaflets. Cool. And Stefan's going to be sort of asking him about, you know, what the Labour Party especially can do about inequality and why it matters. So, thank you.
Thank you, Nan. Well, good evening. Thank you very much for having me. It's a nice, crisp Oxford night. If any of you thought this was going to be Charles Moore talking about Margaret Thatcher, that's happening at LMH. And if you leave now, I mean, it's about a 15-20 minute walk, isn't it, if I remember rightly? So, you know, if you're in the wrong room, go now. But this is Danny Dory, and we're going to talk about, arguably, the legacy of Margaret Thatcher, to some extent, and her continuing influence, among other things, in the context of inequality and injustice. Now, as you know, as a journalist, I always like to do profound research before interviews, and so here's a copy of this evening's Evening Standard, and just to read some of the headlines: London's living standards fall. UK average home hits £536,000. Worker killed as 5 tons of steel falls on him at tycoon's home. Fire rips through city manager's house, his modest £3.5 million Bayswater home in a street with £10 million houses. Sexism at Imperial College, and what was the other one I saw about estate agents? 200 new estate agency branches opened in London's high streets over the past year. There are now nearly 3,000 estate agencies, more than all the butchers, greengrocers and fishmongers combined. So, this was a random selection, Danny, but quite a stark picture of continuing deepening inequality. Is that a fair assessment of tonight's paper?
It is bad. It's spectacularly bad, really. I mean, it's possibly going to be the worst headlines I think we're going to get this week. For those of you who read the Telegraph,
just see the opposition.
Front page story in the Telegraph today was that we've had the biggest absolute rise in deaths since at least the 1960s occurred last year. Tomorrow's front page of the Daily Mail is the same, although they go a bit further and say since the war. And they have the most stunning graph, which I think will be on the front of the paper, just showing this rapid increase in elderly people having died last year. Which we know isn't due to the flu or due to the flu vaccine being no good. We don't think it is due to a large number of expats sneaking their way back into Britain. It almost certainly fits with the cuts to home visits, the cuts to Meals on Wheels. And it's having a toll. And the reason why I say the worst ever headlines this week is it's very, very hard to think of this happening again next year. We've had increased numbers of people over 80 dying, particularly women, first of all, on their own dying in the last few years. We're running out of ones that could die. I mean, that's how bad it is. So I'm waiting to see how Jeremy Hunt reacts to the Daily Mail tomorrow. We have now the highest economic inequality in all of Europe. Our best off 10% take 20%, 28% of all income. Nowhere else in Europe do the best off 10% take such a large share, and this is a share of declining national income. There are a couple of countries which have been badly hit by austerity, Greece and I think Italy, where the bottom 10% takes slightly less now than our bottom 10%. But we're going to fix that soon, because the cuts to come are actually going to mean that our poorest will be worse off than the poorest in those two countries. And driving it all, I think, is the take of the 1%. Because if you look at that top 28% take by the best off 10, and all of you, almost all of you, are going to end up in that best off 10. Half of the income is taken by the 1%. But at least 14% of all income is taken by the 1%, leaving 14% for the other 9% to share amongst themselves. And so you get this scrabbling at the top of English society. People behaving in terrible ways, people being willing to watch others suffer because they're worried about their own positions and what's going to happen to them. And some are trying to crawl their way up into that upper echelon. And it gets even worse when you look within that upper echelon, because you find at the bottom of the 1%, people say they're struggling. Because you can't actually get a mortgage for a three-bed house in Fulham if you are at the bottom of the 1%. This is just awful. It's no matter how you look at it, it is awful. We can talk about how we got here. But I've never seen anything as bad as this. I've never seen death rates rise like this. I've never seen the number of suicides which are now being attributed to people being sanctioned. There are papers in medical journals coming out almost weekly, having gone through peer review and being refereed, saying the evidence is stacking up. This is bad. So the good news is, you know, it is very hard to see it getting worse from here. And if people only begin to realise that they cannot scrabble above this, then the scope for doing something about it is very, very great. Because in the 1980s, if you're talking about Margaret Thatcher, one thing Margaret Thatcher and her chancellors did brilliantly is they didn't just look after the 1%, although they looked after them better than anybody else. They looked after that other section of society just beneath them. And so people who were in the 10% but not in the 1% saw their real incomes rise faster than the average every year that Maggie was in power. And if you're rewarding the top 10% of society and you manage to fall another 20% of people that they might be in that group, you've got yourself a solid block of support. You have a few Norman Pebbits and you can scrape up some other folks. This isn't the case anymore.
Do people in Whitehall, I mean in officialdom, do they challenge the data that you've just described? Do they recognise the data? Do they find it futile to bring that data to the attention of cabinet ministers and ministers? Or what's the gap between the facts, as you describe them, and political action reaction?
I've never seen these figures challenged. Nobody's ever challenged them to me. I think at the top of government, inequality is still seen as reflecting natural differences between human beings and rewarding talent. I think that view is strongly held by a lot of ministers, and maybe by quite a lot of senior civil servants, or the ones who've stayed in it and are stomaching it, and who managed to stay up there. This is simply natural, it is efficient, it is good, it gets rid of waste. It is not necessarily a bad thing. I think that is the dominant view at the top of elite British society. It would be nice if we could all have more, but we can't, and we mustn't penalise the wealth creators. That's what you hear constantly. Yeah.
That's the rhetoric, certainly. Of course, that bit of the Conservative Party used to be quite a substantial bit that would have been engaged and more concerned about the sort of numbers you're talking about has shrunken away or died or retired or left the front line of politics.
It's got old, but the old One Nation Tories, who did believe in innate differences but didn't see that those innate differences needed to be expressed by such wide differentials, they are old and on the back bench. They're certainly not the kind of young people who joined the Conservative Party in 1984 and 86 and 85 here. He just didn't do that. If you're a One Nation Conservative, you didn't join a Conservative Party in Oxford in the 80s.
Well, indeed.
You joined another party.
Didn't Boris let it be believed that he was really an SDP character when he won the union presidency? That's the story.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember we're now governed by a set of people who, as teenagers, thought that Margaret Thatcher, after the miners' strike, was the best thing ever. It's a very peculiar group of people who entered the Conservative Party. Then that group got towards the top. They had for them, you've got to turn yourselves around and think in their shoes. Mm. They had their terrible 13 years out of power, where this awful man, Tony Blair, wasn't quite following in. They did celebrate the fact he had Maggie into number 10, and they thought he'd learned some lessons. They thought the Labour Party was more grown up politics is how they call it, and sensible. But this was, for them, a terrible set of years. And they finally really only got power in May of last year, because they were shackled by the Liberal Democrats. And we're now seeing to what extent the Liberal Democrats did shackle them. Not completely. These sanctions that came in under Liberal Democrats. Sarah Teber resigned, it turns out, because of them. But the sanctions, if you just take the sanctions, which are an idea taken from America, the amount of money which was taken away from people, mainly women, who failed to turn up for an appointment, often because they were looking after a child who was sick at school and so on, the amount of money in 1 year was more than the entire fines handed out by all the magistrates' courts of England and Wales and all the sheriff's courts of Scotland combined. So we decided to penalise the poorest people in Britain on benefits more than we fine all the criminals of the country. And that was under the coalition. That's what a muted set of Conservative ministers do. What's happening now is what happens if you're allowed to finally realise your teenage dreams. That's what you'll see. These are people who are teenagers the same time I was a teenager. And they are in power. They have a set of strongly held beliefs which they think will make Britain great again. They believe that people like me are purely misguided, soppy, not properly educated, not understanding the kind of A-level economics that they did back then, and they're conviction politicians. I don't believe they are deliberately cruel, the majority of them. I do believe they think they're doing a public service. They know they could be earning so much more money out of government and do well afterwards. But they're not sitting there thinking, how can we hurt the poor? They're sitting there thinking, we are doing good. And in a way, that's even more dangerous, because there is this strong, strong conviction that you need more competition between schools, that you need people to really want a job, any job. And that if we do become even more unequal, that's not a problem. It's plan A, it's success. We need to get more billionaires in. We need to get more people working in service for those billionaires.
And if London and the South East becomes a kind of exclusion zone in terms of accommodation costs, that's just the way it is.
That's just the way it is, and it's a good thing. So the MP for Henley recently issued a press release celebrating the fact that he has the lowest rate of job seekers allowance in his constituency in the country. Now, of course, somewhere has to have the lowest rate of job seekers allowance claims in the country. The fact it's Henley shows that it is not possible to live in Henley if you find yourself unemployed. The rate of poverty in Henley is still very high, but all the people who are poor and all the children who are poor have parents in work. But it's celebrated as a good thing for Henley. Get those people out, at least as far as Birmingham, if not to Liverpool. That's where they can go and that's where they can be.
So the facts are depressing, but as you said in your book on injustice, that this idea that despair is inevitable is one of the sort of mythical pillars, if you like, or one of the delusions that some of these people, perhaps on the right, would like to inculcate and spread in people. And your new book that's out next month, it's called A Better Politics. So you're clearly taking despair head on in that sense. You're refusing to give in to despair offering something better.
I'm trying to be optimistic. Yeah. I am genuinely pretty optimistic about what might be possible. I think the worst thing that could happen is actually the Labour Party takes a separate parliament. You know, if that can be avoided, then the potential for good things happening are great. If the Labour Party can really grow up in what I call growing up, which means talking with the Greens. Larry Sanders, the Green candidate, is speaking elsewhere in these buildings now. He's been candidate, I think, for Oxford West. We've got the candidate for the National Health Alliance at the back. The inability of people on the left to talk to those who are nearest to them in belief is quite shocking. I see no need for that. Just a little bit of cooperation, including even with Scotland, would not hurt at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the other reasons to be optimistic is this is in almost nobody's interest. If there was a group of people where it made sense to carry on like this, it would be harder. Or if there's an obvious way in which you lot could be bought off, we can find enough jobs in Canary Wharf for you and enough jobs in banking where the fact that you've got a degree in history doesn't really matter, we can take you in.
Other career paths are available. I should say. That's morally, moral tutor.
But the traditional way of keeping things as they are doesn't work when so few people are gaining. And when you look at what it means to gain, it isn't really something worth striving that hard to get. You don't see great levels of happiness amongst those at the top of British society. So what I've done in the book is that I've looked at lots of people's studies of happiness, lots of American economy studies of happiness, and they find that once you get below the superficial measure of happiness, which is, how do you feel on a scale from 1 to 10? Americans always rank highest on that kind of thing. How are you? I'm awesome. That kind of thing. Once you get beneath that, people's well-being and levels of good mental health is higher in those affluent countries which organise things better and in a more collective way and more sensibly, and which don't let a small proportion of society take so much. And then you can begin to go through different areas like education and health and jobs and say, what levers does government have to affect those events which most make people unhappy? What can they do to influence that? And you can even go as far as looking at things like people's rates of separation and divorce, which are higher here than they are in countries with lower rates of economic inequality. Because the stress on your daily lives of living in an unequal society, the stress to worry about what work you're doing, what you're getting in, are you living in the right school catchment area, all of that means, are you commuting a long way because that gets you the better job? You get on worse with the people nearest and dearest around you. And so you can make a much broader argument about our well-being in general, not just about jobs and salaries and wages, but about splitting up, getting to know your children, seeing them, not seeing them as disappointments. Lovely word. If the Conservatives are ever very, very, very angry with somebody, the word is, I was disappointed. That's the strongest word.
Well, if you see education as a sort of contested or positional good and it's literally an investment, you're disappointed if the return on capital employed in the child concern doesn't quite live up to...
Yeah.
And I mean, always hilarious, really, when people have spent lots of money expecting that their kids are going to get into this university or the other university in Cambridge, and then don't. And they regard that as, they've wasted their investment on the expense of education.
You've let yourself down, you've let your school down, you've let the family down. And this doesn't happen elsewhere in Europe. Of course, there is utopia, but there's nowhere else in Europe which spends a quarter of our secondary education spending on just 70% of children,
A quarter
of the total public and private monies we spend on secondary education are spent on just 7% of children who go private. Within the private sector, of course, there are huge inequalities of how much is spent. There are a large number of very poor private schools, which are not talked about very much. But in the most expensive, supposedly brilliant public schools, boys are being worked at 10 o'clock at night. Because an A really is a failure. You know, an A star is success. We just got ourselves in a mess. And it isn't like this elsewhere. Yeah. Elsewhere in Europe, you go to the nearest school, there are some divisions. You might be divided between a gymnasium and something else. But you tend to go to the local university. You can choose what kind of job you want to do with far more freedom, because jobs are not ranked so much. They're paid much better at the bottom and they're paid much less at the top. And you can mix with who you want to mix far more. It's that those kind of changes to British society that have occurred since the 60s and 70s, where people are segregated into different areas of different social groups. I think that's particularly pernicious.
And I suppose we're waiting also for that weight of data to be responded to by the, also that sort of intergenerational question of grandparents and parents seeing the reality of the world around them and worrying about their children. Yeah. And that somehow sort of join the dots politically.
There's a question about this. I mean, so far we have just three years of students who paid the full £9,000 a year. So we're looking at an average debt of £56,000 on an average salary, but if they get a good job, which is only £31,000-£32,000 a year, but better than most people in Britain get, you're looking at a debt of £100,000. By 2020, we'll have 8 years' worth of students. Well, this is the biggest debt anybody can have in Europe for their education. 8 years' worth of students, 8 years' worth of parents, 8 years' worth of grandparents. And presumably by this time, mum's debt will have cottoned on to it. Everybody's always hoping for the political power of mum's net. Because all these, and mothers have much more interest in their children's futures than fathers, sadly. All these parents who are trying to get their children to behave in this particular way to get to university might begin to work out, A, they can change the terms and conditions of your loan retrospectively at any time, as they just did last autumn. But also, you're not going to get those salaries. Because the salary distribution is now so skewed that future graduates are not going to get the kind of salaries that past graduates got. I mean, not least half of all young women in England now go to university. So the kind of revolution you need for graduate salaries to be high enough to repay the loans involves men's salaries very quickly dropping below women's. There's no way of squaring it. And that's just one of the things that's happened.
Well, you mentioned Mumsnet. Of course, this week we've had one other national newspaper committing to an online-only future. How much of this, and please be as rude as you like about journalists, so I won't be offended, how much of this is down to a London media machine shaping and framing debate? Perhaps, my impression, not so much necessarily print as broadcasters who are nominally impartial and yet perhaps arguing within a framework that's...
Well, we have a newspaper industry now which is just solely concentrated in London, so only winners get there. You know, you have to do your service outside, you get into London. Where the newspapers are best on, particularly Telegraph, is house prices in London, because successful journalists can't actually get a mortgage unless they can get enough of an inheritance.
Yeah.
And they dislike the fact that it doesn't matter how hard you work, the question is how much money Grandad has. So they are good at that. At the top of the BBC, the upper echelons of West London, you know, whenever they retire, it turns out that they actually voted Conservative. That the default...
Not Alistair Milne, maybe.
No, not all good. The default political position in the BBC is actually One Nation Toryism. It's quite, you know, if there's anywhere that it's being kept alive,
Well, the famous sort of so-called lefty BBC, and how many of them have taken jobs with the government? I mean, it's more than a handful.
Yeah.
Leading social politicians.
This is the presenters, not all of them. So what's really interesting, if you go into the BBC, is that the presenter is arguing against you about inequality. But everybody else in the room, the producer, the sound person, the camera people, are nodding. But of course, they're on less than a third.
They're on the screen.
Yeah, of the person.
Yes, that's an interesting point. Absolutely. Now, I don't want to hog this all, you know, believe in democracy, don't we, and free speech, and perhaps you've already got some questions bubbling up. If not, I'll carry on, but I'm very happy to take some at this point if anyone's already been provoked by something. Yes?
So, Professor Bolling, I was thinking about political terms, and I had a lecture from Andrew Dilmar, who used to work at the Office of National Statistics, and he argued that the inequality between the bottom 10% and the top 10% is actually far lower than is perceived by a lot of individuals. Yeah. Now, and another statistic which came out of Forbes that says the composition of the 1%, 90% of that composition will change in any 20-year period. Mm. How do you think the Labour Party should frame its debate in order to show that this is unjust? Because on a most superficial level, this sounds quite meritocratic. About four times between the bottom 10% and the top 10% sounds like the kind of thing that could come out of ability.
That statistic is the 10th percentile to the 90th percentile. Mm. So Cameron famously quoted this, because then it's got better. The actual gap between the person who is 10 percentage points up from the bottom and the person who is 10 percentage points down from the top has fallen in the last 10 years at least. The IFS has shown that inequalities amongst 99% of the population have fallen. This is, as long as you ignore the 1%, we're all in it together. But the problem is that the 1% are taking a very large amount and more and altering the behaviour of the people just beneath them. Over the composition of the 1% changing, the majority of the 1% are men in their 50s or early 60s. So they have to change in 20 years because another set of men in there, so that they look very similar, but they're obviously different. Because you don't get to the position of having an income of £200,000 to £250,000 a year until later in your career. But they're not changing that rapidly in other ways. They come from similar families, similar social classes, and from a large number of people who have immigrated into the country. But that was the case in the past as well. We always get, immigrants tend to be more dynamic in general in the world. They've got get up and go. The Labour Party, I think, has to understand that you cannot ignore the take of the very richest. In those countries where the very richest take the least, which are places like Japan, where people live the longest, or all the Scandinavian countries, other things get sorted out in society. Because you don't end up with a group at the top who so totally exclude themselves, who don't use the same hospitals. You certainly don't use the schools. The 1%, hardly anybody in the 1% will use a state school. Whereas in other countries, a fair number of the top 1% will, and certainly just beneath them, they will. It's explaining that disconnect. To take the 1% correlates with social harm better than any other inequality statistic. The Gini statistic, if you're nerdy about this, because I'm in the right place for and earliness. The Gini statistic is one of the worst correlates because it's really insensitive. The 1% is just treated as if they're 1% of the issue. And so...
Oh, there's no weighting in a Gini coefficient?
No, it's not. It has the advantage of it uses information within the entire distribution.
Yes.
But if what's actually most damaging is how much people at the top take, it's not very good for that. And there is an opposite side to this very sad. It doesn't appear to terribly affect your society how badly you treat the bottom 1%. I would keep this one quiet. The bottom 1% in Japan are treated very badly. They are homeless and in blue tents, very neat blue tents. But Japanese society as a whole produces a whole lot of statistics which show it does very well. This is the opposite to the standard Labour rhetoric. The standard Labour rhetoric is, we don't care what the rich get as long as they pay their taxes, we will tackle poverty. We'll make things better at the bottom. Now that's fine, that's good to do, but that doesn't actually make the whole of society better or reduce your overall problem. Quoting greed at the top appears to be far, far more effective, and it saves an enormous amount of money. Because if you don't waste this money on salaries that people don't need, the firms and businesses they work for can pay other people a fair amount of money. They're not constantly trying to get the wages of the lowest paid down or keep them down.
Yes, there are also some very perverse incentives in these top salaries. If it's tied to share price, very much short-term incentive to engineer the share price up to collect a lot of money and clear off leaving the business in whatever state you leave it in.
And you also say the way to achieve in life is money.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a fundamental message that says success is how much you can make, rather than success is how much you might be respected by your peers, success is whether you're seen as a nice Norwegian or somebody in France who you know, cares about other people in France. Or
how much you contribute, yeah, rather than take.
And that ethos trickles down from the top. You know, your value is the money. If you don't have much money, it's because you're not worth much. If you try harder to show you're worth more, you will get paid more, and that will be fair. That whole way of thinking becomes normal.
You're talking a bit about, and I think you refer to it in the Injustice book, this sort of drift away from that sense of the collective, of the common good, the common purpose, which of course was perhaps at its height. Don't want to be too golden, rose-tinted about this, but obviously during World War II and just after it, this period of reconstruction. And is it, I mean, this is my crude sense, that as we move further and further away from 1945, some of those sort of pre-World War II notions reassert themselves. My dad, who came to this country just at the time of the war, said he recognised Mrs. Thatcher very well. That's how people used to talk.
Yeah.
She's 1930s grandfather.
The 1930s that came back.
Yeah.
Yeah, and something happened in this country in the 30s. If you look at our inequality levels, they were highest in 1913. They then fell after the First World War, partly because we had to tax people to pay for the First World War. So all their stately homes, which were donated to National Trust, weren't donated willingly. Then you have a revolution in Russia, which scared the people at the top of society. We had a general strike in 26. We had an almighty financial crash in 1929. We didn't immediately learn from that, and the same in America, and the same this time. There wasn't an immediate, this doesn't make sense, we need to rethink how things go.
Yeah.
But by the 1930s, by the mid-1930s, young men in particular, because young men had the power, young women were just still trying to get the vote, at least the vote at 18. Young men didn't trust the generation above them. The generation above them had caused the banks to crash, it caused mass unemployment. They were particularly angry with the generation above them, who had gone to a world war which would have been hard to foresee, and were about to make them go and fight in another world war. These are people like Tawney, who was here, and Rutledge, who was here, and Attlee, who was here. And they didn't trust their parents' generation because of what they'd done. So when they got power in 45, they changed things so radically that the Conservative Party had to move. And the Conservative Party moved rapidly to the left. Macmillan built more council houses a year than Labour had ever managed. The whole pendulum swung.
Brad Butler said we're all social democrats now, I think, at one point.
It was a federal change.
Probably joking.
An interesting thing, if you're here, is a key amount of it happened here. Beveridge was a eugenicist in the 1920s. He was a pretty awful man when he was young. His views changed. You can see it in his writings. He just stopped saying things he used to say. He remained a liberal. But the Labour government, a Labour government at home, the country was run by Labour at home during the war. The Conservatives ran the war, Labour were given the country.
Early Behn.
Yeah. And so you get the welfare state created from that. But it Now, nobody's sending you to war, but they're doing everything else, everything else for you.
So you're looking at either end there, saying, and certainly the, you know, if you look at inequalities, you can sort of work out, you can sort of go figure. If you know the facts about the inequalities, then, you know, an awful lot of us comes from thinking about it, as you say, and you get interesting, have an interesting debate about what the significance of the lower 10%, lowest 1% is, because there's a fear factor there which conditions the thoughts of other people. But there could be grounds for optimism if, for instance, the whole of the middle ground was really levelling, because then, you know, there'd be solidarity and scope. As you say, most people would gain from a different model and from addressing those inequalities at either end. And what would be particularly worrying is if the top 1% could look at divisions, at differences, at inequalities somewhere in between, which in UK is, you know, characterised by, you know, the class, by working class and middle class. But my perception is that actually there's grounds for optimism in that the middle class is seeing, you are seeing a levelling, you're seeing the lack of distinction between the two, but I don't know the facts, I don't know what's happening in the middle.
You're seeing a levelling when it comes to incomes. I would assume people in the Conservative Party are trying to work out where can you put a new cleavage. Where you're not getting a levelling is over housing wealth. So what the Conservatives do is defend your housing wealth if you've got it. Do everything they can to hold up house prices to the ridiculous point. I thought they would stop after the election, but to the ridiculous point of now giving you a 40% government loan if you buy a house or flat for less than £600,000 in London. This has just come in. So almost every flat or house going for £350 or £450, which is ridiculous, you're never going to get these. It's going to go up to £600,000. But the cleavage they've tried to exploit, and the way they succeeded in the Leighton, is looking after the savers, the people who have deferred gratification, the people who have paid their mortgage, and looking after their interests, which is why the only group who increased their support for them in May 2015 were over 65s. Yeah. There's falling support enough for every other demographic. But that's the one they've gone for. Their worry is that there won't be enough new mortgage holders, so Help to Buy has been extended to desperately try to make it possible to create more people who are in that camp. Where they could really get them stuck is if people begin to realise that those semis in the Leighton are not worth the value they currently have. And one key reason they're not worth it, apart from the fact we have the highest house prices now in the world, in London, is that new first-time buyers tend to be around 31, 32, 33, which is what you're going to be in about 10 years' time, and you're going to have a student debt that you haven't repaid. And so when you go to borrow some money, they have to subtract your student debt from what you can be lent. So you can't buy these houses off people who think the houses are worth this much in the future.
Yeah. I have two separate point of clarification.
You're doing very well.
One question. Point of clarification. I believed it was consistently the government position across both Labour and the Conservative that the student debt will actually not be considered in the taking out of any other financial products. So.
But the government can't tell a bank what not to consider.
No, in terms of the disclosure figures, which is point of clarification. The more interesting question for me was in terms of trends and what you think of the financial sector. So for me, the things that you described are not because the statistics are correct, but I doubt the extent to which they're due to government policy. For instance, we have a stronger financial sector than any of the other European countries. Margaret Thatcher did a lot for the financial services within the City of London. Do you think that actually it's tackling the financial sector will be one of the root methods of tackling the issue of the 1%? Because for me, it's very much to do with this sort of financial mobilisation when we look throughout history, when we're looking at through recent economic.
We've made ourselves reliant on the financial sector. So it employed about 4% of people and produced 12% of GDP. So whenever you talk about doing anything, people say, oh, if you damage the financial sector, you can't have the NHS. What we don't realise is we spend per head half what they spend in Switzerland, 49% less than what they spend in Germany on health. So our amazing financial sector, which supposedly underpins our economy, is actually leading to us not having as good a situation as countries that don't have this. We also have an extreme situation with the financial sector. So the European Central Bank survey salaries. We tried to stop them and failed. We have now over 2,200 bankers paid over €1 million a year. The next highest is about 200 in Germany. There were fewer people paid as much in the whole of the rest of Europe. So whenever people say that they just leave, I mean, they're paid half as much in Switzerland on average to be a banker. You have to ask where they would go. But going back to what the government says you can disclose or not disclose, mortgage companies and banks know that 90-95% of university graduates will have a loan. They know there's a small group whose parents have the ability to pay three lots of £9,000. It was possibly, I'll get the figure wrong, we knew it when it was £3,000, it may have been as much as a third of the graduates of this university. But no other university was it quite as high. It won't be a third, now it's 9,000, but it could still be about a tenth. One in 10 of you, mum and dad are quietly paying the college check. I won't ask anybody to reveal that, but they know it. But one reason why the government was in favour of student loans is that their children wouldn't have to have them. One reason why the sector was in favour of student loans, I didn't go out on the streets and campaign against them, is that the alternative in 2010 was that one in four of my colleagues and perhaps myself would be made unemployed. That's what the sector was presented with. You either take £9,000 a year, or you take the same cut that's being doled out to the rest of the public sector. So the student loans have avoided buncey. Then what happened? They assume they get a market. They didn't get a market. Everybody goes up £9,000. Yes. The entire sector ends up with £1 billion more than it had before of money that you're going to have to repay. And the thing is, that if you default and you don't pay it, it'll have to be repaid by taxpayers. That's going to be you. I'll be retired.
With a triple lock on your pension?
With a triple lock. Reason, you know, it's not the kind of retirement I want. No. I have kids.
Now, just on the financial sector point, and then I'll come to you. Under the 30-year rule a couple of years ago, there's a fantastic, and it came out at Christmas, New Year, so you may not have noticed it. I don't know, I noticed it at the time. A memo from Robert Armstrong, then Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet secretary, in advance of Big Bang, as it was called in 1986, that's on great deregulation of the city, saying, Prime Minister, I am hearing, anecdotally, that there's already some very sharp practices emerging, very unpleasant behaviours. I do think we should have a regard, it's all in Mandarin, you know, regard to what the implications of Big Bang might be. It's a sort of chilling, to use a Germanese expression, it's a startling document, because Rob Armstrong kind of knew what was coming, I think. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so given there's the problem of the 1%, how do you see that being tackled? Is it through taxes?
Good question.
On income? I mean, now given there's the wealth problem as well, how can we get that?
Piketty talks about a super tax.
Yeah, Peter, the Welsh do, sorry, the French, not the Welsh, don't mind. The French, the French do have wealth taxes, which we don't. The Welsh have a higher council tax band.
Ah.
You know, so there are numerous things you can begin to do.
Mm.
You could have the kind of property taxation in London that they have in New York. You know, New York is not a socialist city, but it has property taxes that raise far more, and people can't move their property. You cannot easily demolish it and transfer it.
Yeah.
Its value is because it's in London, not because it looks like that.
I think Martin Wolf in the FT has argued for land taxes for a long time.
Yeah, and Winston Churchill argued for land value tax because he didn't inherit Blenheim. That's why he was born. So we could begin to bring in wealth taxation. We've begun to do things. Under Osborne, we've got rid of capital gains tax exclusion for non-doms and so on, so this has actually been begun already. Over income tax, I would think about raising the top rate to the average top rate in Europe, which is only 51%, 52%, 53%.
We're almost there
until
recently.
It sends a
briefly
signal.
There. Yeah.
And the reason you do it is not to raise money. This is the main point that people be made, right? You have a higher top paper tax. I would have a higher one, people earning over a million, higher, two million. You don't want to raise money from your top paper tax. You want to help people who are maybe naturally greedy not to worry so much about arguing their salary up from 3 million to 5 million, because most of that increase will go straight to the Treasury. And you want to help the board of the bank who's deciding whether this precocious young man, who happens to appear to be quite good at dealing with some computers in the basement of the bank, they should also be more reluctant. So high rates of taxation on high incomes are there to protect the greedy from themselves and the rest of us, not to raise money. I mean, the extreme example I can give is Jeremy Clarkson. How would it help Jeremy Clarkson, who tends to have quite a high income? Jeremy is a man older than me. It's not good to work too long at my age. Your chances of stroke, as my doctor at the back could probably tell me, go up dramatically if you work over 50 or 60 hours a week. If somebody like Jeremy decides that he really wants to fly to Australia for a week and film some other episode of driving around in the bush with a Jeep, on a high rate of marginal income tax, he has to decide he wants to do that just for the love of it. And all the money he makes will go to help everybody else. So I actually see it beneficial for people at the top. And in those societies with high rates of top income tax, the best off do better. The classic example is ABBA. You know, they chose to stay in Sweden. Yeah. They are still all alive. if you look at their equivalents in the 1970s in the US, who stayed in ranches in the US? Lots of them are dead.
The winner takes it all.
If you encourage high taxes on the super wealthy, doesn't that encourage them to hide their taxes or leave the country?
They already hide. In fact, they hide with our assistance. We are the country which rubber stamps most of the tax havens of the world, you know, who have the British flag flying over them. So if we're worried about tax avoidance, we should talk to our own government. And we can do this. The Americans can't sort it out. The Americans have sorted out Switzerland. They've come to a deal with Switzerland, whereby the Swiss have to reveal the contents of the Swiss bank accounts. And coincidentally, at the time that happened, loads of money exited those bank accounts and moved into London, to the property market. So we have it in our power to get rid of tax avoidance more than any other country does. If they leave, this is the problem, what will happen if they leave? What will happen if those youngsters in Mayfair driving their cars around in the season? You know, the seasons come back again? There used to be these 3 months when you used to come into town to London, you know, in the Edwardian period. And it's out and about, you come into town from Abu Dhabi now. Okay, a series of department stores will do less well. Other businesses, which I won't name, will do less well. People always talk about the wealth creators, and we'd lose the wealth creators. And then they begin to scrabble around for who this wealth creator is. And eventually they end up with a man whose name is immortalised on the vacuum cleaner. He's our top wealth creator. But the jobs have now gone overseas from that. I find it hard. We don't tend to have a particularly beneficent set of people at the top in our society. We're the only major rich country which doesn't have a rich person who's come out and said, this is wrong. There are numerous examples in the States. Warren Buffett saying it's wrong that he pays a lower rate of tax than his secretary. All across Europe, there is one or two prominent rich person in each country saying this is wrong, in far more equal countries than us. We haven't got one, which is quite remarkable.
And less philanthropy here as well, I think.
Yeah.
There's a question here in the blue top.
Yep. You mentioned earlier that you thought the Labour Party should be in contact with like the Greens and other parties to the left. I was just wondering what you, because from my understanding, like elements of the media would give them a really hard time for that and perhaps like shift public opinion. So I'm trying to tie that into how you see a Labour Party or a party of the left winning an election, considering there's all this rhetoric about people naturally being to the right in the UK. I was wondering if you could...
Well, and they played, the media played that game with the SNP vote and said towards the end of that May vote, you know, if you vote for Labour, you'll get the Scottish National Party, the coalition. And the media don't point out when the Conservatives and Liberals do this, which they did in Sheffield Hallam. The Conservatives quietly walked away. They had a candidate, nobody knew who the candidate was, because the Conservatives really wanted Clegg to hold that seat, because Conservatives did not expect to win. It was the most amazing result. A lot of the result was due to some chance. Everything just fell in the right way. And then, of course, their advisor claimed a credit he now has knighted. But when you look at it, it is stunning that they got a majority. Mm. Apparently, this Andrew Marr said this at St Peter's publicly a few weeks ago, apparently Cameron had already agreed with Jeremy Hunt that Hunt would take over as interim leader. And this was a discussion in Number 10 at 5 or 6 o'clock at night. That night, in the event of it being worse than they thought.
Yeah.
And they thought the best they could get would be a coalition again with Liberals, which is why they needed Clegg.
Yeah.
They were utterly shocked by the exit poll. And the exit poll turned out to correlate with the actual result. You can form alliances without the media spotting it. So in the seat of Chester, where there's fracking proposed to happen on the edge of Chester, the Greens did not put up a candidate, and Labour won it. It's normally a Tory seat. Normally, Labour won it by less than 100 votes. If the Greens had put up a candidate, Labour would have won Chester. No national agreement. It's a local understanding. You don't need to have a national agreement. You just have to have an understanding. Mm. So if you find that you're saying very similar things to what is actually happening in Scotland, and I agree this is a long shot. John McDonnell today was rubbishing the Scots again. But if you find that your policies are increasingly similar to what's done in Scotland, and you also notice that Scotland has widened educational participation, has improved health at a faster rate than England, then you can begin not to attack, or has brought in laws to stop letting agents exploit people, is thinking about rent regulation in Edinburgh, the second financial, you know, why on earth attack the Scots when the Scots are actually moving ahead and creating something different? And lastly, over the Greens, you can either keep your current stance with the Greens, which is that they're terrible, we must fight them everywhere, or you can find them somewhere to go. And at the moment they only have Brighton, and they need at least four other places. They need somewhere in Bristol, they need somewhere in Norwich, they need somewhere up north, which is probably York Central, and they probably need somewhere in London, that's actually the hardest to identify. And if you have that, then all those Greens in Oxfordshire, who might annoy you, can stop wasting their time in Oxford East where they haven't got a chance, which is really ironic because it should be a Green target seat, but it isn't. And they can get on the Green Eco Bus or cycle, and during the election campaign, they can go to York. And this kind of thing becomes possible when the seat boundaries are redrawn. Because when the seat boundaries were redrawn, nobody owns any seat anymore. What makes it really hard to do at the moment is that the current Labour MPs in all these target seats have made themselves ever so green, because so many of their constituents are green.
Now, I think there are two, yes, at the back there and then next, yes. Might be our last two.
Two points. One, really, I just wanted to talk a little about inequality, and there's been a lot of fuss in the press about whether you're more likely to die at the weekend. It's really difficult to get the press interested in the fact that you're more likely to die if you're poor. And the huge inequalities about how much sooner you die, even between one bit of Oxford and another bit of Oxford, let alone between Dorset and some of the poorer bits around Liverpool. But the second thing, I just wanted to put a bit of a downer on your optimism of maybe it won't get any worse. Because I think if the NHS continues to be torn apart in the way it is at the moment, that safety net we have at the moment, which is roughly equal access to care across the country, only roughly, but it's kind of there, is going to disappear, and when we have devolution to local authorities, to Manchester to start with, and it's you know, coming, then we will get greater and greater inequalities with our access to health care.
That's right, you're completely right, but the first point is really, really important. 6,000 children die a year in this country. We have the highest infant mortality rate in Western Europe. Only Romania and another country whose name I should know from that part of Europe where you don't tend to remember the names. You know, they're the only two places. Our children die at twice the rate of children in Sweden of every single cause. Road traffic accidents, the congenital malformations of the heart. It's across the board. So,
Our rich
children are not doing any better than rich children in other countries. And when you look at their mental health and their self-harming and the cutting and the anorexia, that's also not good. So, just looking at the overall level and saying how poor it's got, but we do have the cheapest health system in the rich world. It's so bloody efficient that we've managed to cut it down and down and down to this level. But we've got to a point when the first picket line that the new leader of the Labour Party gets to stand on is a picket line with junior doctors. And at this point, you sort of think, if you can't win this, when the junior doctors, you know, the BMA in the 80s was solidly conservative. If you cannot create some sort of solidarity when you've got this set of articulate people arguing for roughly the same kind of thing. My worry was that they pay off the junior doctors and the rest of the top 10% of society. Mm. But if they're going to take a battle with the junior doctors, then the scope for working together is large. And if you saw the junior doctors in the latest strike, they were in groups of three in Cornmarket on Broad Street with little placards saying, come and talk to me about what job I do. You know, it looked, you know, this is a kind of organisation that the kind of revolutionary groups I never got to join because I was born slightly too late used to do in the 1970s. You know, but it used to be, you know, somebody pretending to be a worker selling a newspaper in Cornmarket. Now it's three junior doctors. And people don't talk to them.
I never bought one of those, must have. And perhaps our last question about that.
So, in light of the fact you were saying that the Conservatives, themselves were surprised at their election victory, why do you think they did gain a majority?
Why did they do it? Nothing to do with Scotland. All those seats could have gone to Labour, Miss Himmelberg. the collapse of the Liberals. And Liberals had won in areas that were naturally conservative far more. Complacently by people like me, because I'd been living in Sheffield for 10 years when the Labour vote rose, I spent most of my time in London when the Labour vote rose, I spent my time talking to young people when the Labour vote rose, I come talk to these when the Labour Party vote rose twice.
We believed the polls, didn't we? We believed the polls. We wanted to believe them.
Wanted to believe the polls. Yeah. Maybe a lack of distinction. Ed Miliband wasn't that radical. It wasn't that different. I wouldn't blame leaders' personalities. And the reason I wouldn't do that is if you look back in time, they all had pretty awful personalities. Barbara Castle wasn't, you know, some kind of messiah before she became a minister. Howard Wilson wasn't. None of them were. They were made into these figures afterwards when the history was written. Mm. Attlee couldn't public speak. Mm. That they're all gawks and geeks before Maggie Thatcher shrieked.
Yeah.
And okay, she had some work done on how to present herself. But don't agonise about the charisma of individual politicians. It's afterwards that they're painted in this way. So I don't think it's that. Fear. Fear was massive in May 2015. The fear overcame hope, and people couldn't be given a message of hope. As things get worse, there's less to fear, because your fears become true, the soup kitchens don't go away. And the other reason, and Osborne played a stunner, is that he spent more money on every budget as Chancellor. He was in charge of the election and the budget. He spent more money on the housing market than anything else. And he got the housing market to keep going up and up and up, whereas it was crashing elsewhere in Europe. In London in the early 1990s, there's an amazing map called the Amazing Shrinking Tories, when all these out of London boroughs, the Conservatives lost control of them when house prices fell. Tories...
Lib Dems
also played with some cases, all no control. Tories don't like walking down to the polling booth and voting when their house price is falling in value. And the house prices were kept high. But getting them up even higher, it's not easy. If I was Osborne, I would be trying to get a mini slump now. I would blame it on Labour scaring people, or on the Scots, or on the world economy.
The Chinese.
Yeah, get the house prices down, then get them up 2 years before the election. Stoking up the London market now just seems to be very, very dangerous.
Well, Danny, you've given us some tough facts, but also some grounds for hope and hints at a better politics, something that might work a bit better for the left. Thank you very much for your time this evening. I'm sure you'd like to thank him for all the interesting